Morning, everyone. Continuing our study in James. Beginning today at chapter 4, verse 1. And I had to think while Derek was referring to the rain, I had to think of the change it made just in the last, say, 2 days after the first shower until now, how the lawns have changed from kind of a parched, dry, brownish to kind of a lush green again. Cornfields have gone from curly leaves, spiky leaves, to flat, healthy-looking, fluffy leaves again. The reason I'm here this morning is not because I believe that you need to be taught what faith is. I'm here because I think we need to be reminded sometimes and refreshed. So it's not like I'm teaching you. We are studying this to revive ourselves like a rain. That was free. Chapter 4, verse 1. Another aspect of faith. My Bible subheading says, faith produces humility. And then it starts talking, and then the text immediately starts talking about war. Is humility and war the opposite? Pretty close. So anyway, let's read it. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lusts. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. So, in verse 1, what causes war? Or fightings? And that term war can be anywhere from literally countries at war to strife between two individuals, I believe. My conclusion was the root cause of war and fightings is mostly the desire to have what we don't have, or the desire to keep what we do have. Verse 2 doesn't actually say it in that many words, but war always destroys more than it obtains for the winner. So if the cause of war or fighting amongst two individuals is the desire to get or keep, it's interesting to note that war always destroys more than what it ends up keeping or getting for the winner. And the loser, of course, loses almost everything. Put in that perspective, it's actually the most foolish venture out there. Because in trying to get, we end up destroying half of what we're trying to get. And in trying to keep, we end up destroying most of what we're trying to keep. It's pure foolishness. So, okay. What's the alternative? I mean, just let the opponent take what he wants? What's God say the solution is? And it's not really a trick question. Ray, up here.
Verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. I think that that would probably be the solution, is to submit yourself to God.
Okay. I'm not gonna knock it. It's not what I was thinking of. In the end of verse 2, it says, we don't have because we don't ask. Now that's way too simple for us adults. We want it to be a little more complicated. And in some cases, it probably is. It does introduce another angle, because we all know that we have asked and not got. So we say it's not that simple. You can't just ask because there's no guarantee you'll get. Am I right? Or is that just me? Over here, Ron, over on this side.
Well, verse 3 says we ask and receive not because we ask amiss. So if we ask wrong, I think in asking we still have to do what verse 7 says. We have to do what verse 7 says before we ask still, or we still won't receive because we're doing it with the wrong motives.
Thank you. Absolutely. If we, going to verse 7, if we submit ourselves to God, resist the devil, and then ask, if we submit ourselves to God, what's that going to do to our asking? And maybe that's too general. The end of verse 3 says, we ask amiss. We ask that we may consume it on our own lusts. So really, when we're asking, when we're praying to God with a request and we're asking for something, are we asking like Saul? Sorry, Solomon. Are we asking for the good of the kingdom? Or are we asking for our own selfish motives? When Solomon was given that opportunity to ask for something and he would be given it, he asked for wisdom to rule the kingdom. Wisdom that would... His reason for asking for wisdom was for the benefit of the kingdom. When he asked for wisdom, the way he worded it, if you reread that, I didn't even look it up to see where it is, but if you read that, the way he asked for wisdom that I might rule this so great thy people Israel, or something like that. His focus wasn't himself. He wasn't asking for wisdom so that he would be known as the most wise king ever. He wanted wisdom so that he could wisely rule or govern God's chosen people. His focus was God's chosen people and that kingdom, not his own way. If we ask in that manner, if we ask for something for the benefit of God's kingdom and his people in it, then I believe we will get. Is that going too far? Somebody care to argue that? Or bring up another angle on it? Good for you, Ray.
care to argue it. And I don't even know if I'm bringing up another angle, but there's a passage in 1 John chapter 3. Perhaps I'll begin reading in verse 19. By this we shall know that we are of the truth and reassure our heart before him. For whenever our heart condemns us, God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and we do what pleases him. And this is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another. I think context is everything when looking at passages like this. We could say, you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions, is what the ESV says, King James says, lust. I think it's in keeping with the entire context of James, not showing partiality, fighting in wars. And these fighting in wars are passions, fleshly desires that this church that James is writing to has amongst them. And so when they ask for something, they're asking for whatever it may be. But it's not just a simple request for rain, for example, even though you could ask for rain so that your crop doesn't fail, so you can spend it on your lusts, for that matter. But I think you understand perhaps where I'm going with this. The context is your selfish ambitions and desires, which is what he's been dealing with up until here. And then if we're asking amiss, it's because we want status or whatever it is that we want, something to feed our ego or our passions, and that's how we're asking amiss. I find it interesting, again, ESV in verse 3 says, therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Whoever wishes to, if we desire the world system of honor and prestige and the things, we make ourselves an enemy of God. If we're asking with those desires, we're asking amiss.
Thank you. And that is a war we dare not start. Yeah. But as far as becoming an enemy of God, so if we want to be, okay, so we know we don't want to be an enemy of God. If we want to be an ally of God, how is that done? In this spiritual warfare that we constantly fight regardless, if we want to be an ally, one of God's allies, or be working with him in that spiritual warfare, how do we get there? And the next, say verse 6 to 11 has a number of different ones. I picked out 8 of them. Somebody want to take a jab at it? Yes. Actually, humility, I might have doubled up on that one, but verse 7, obviously, submission. And verse 10, no. Yeah, verse 10, humble yourselves. Anybody else? Verse 7 also lists resisting evil or the devil. Verse 8 commands us to draw nigh to God, to cleanse our hands, purify our hearts, And 11 says, speak not evil. For me, that's a fairly tall order. But it is the way to avoid becoming an enemy of God, I think. Verse 12 puts another angle onto this wars or fightings or strife amongst ourselves. Points out that there's one lawgiver who is able to save and destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? I paraphrased that. There's one God. We are all subject under him. Why then should we try to be lord over one another? And isn't that the root of these fightings? We want to be better than those around us, or well, yeah. We want to get so that we've got more than the other. Now we get into the interesting section. Verse 13. Come now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. According to verse 15, and I pose this as a question, should all of our plans start with, or should all of our sentences of our plans start with, if the Lord will? So this morning somebody calls me and wants to make plans for today, and I tell them, well, not till after lunch anyway, because I'm committed to teaching Sunday school, so I'm going to be teaching Sunday school here at Hessen. Should that be worded, if the Lord wills, I'll be teaching Sunday school? Jonathan up here.
I suppose that it could be a good thing to have that in our vocabulary a lot more than we do, but I think it's in contrast, it's an attitude in contrast to the first one, which is arrogance, an arrogant attitude, a presumptuous attitude, not giving proper recognition to God's will and submitting ourselves to that. So I think it has a lot to do with our attitude and how we relate to things. If it's in a boastful attitude, or if it's in an attitude of humility that our life is in God's hands. I think that at least is more important than just the words we say in both cases.
Okay, thank you. So back to verse 13. Is that a boast? Or is it just a plan for the day? Or the year in this case? That thing for today or tomorrow, I'm going to go into this city and I'm going to stay there and do business and get gain. Is that a plan? Is that just a business plan, or is that a boast?
Another example would be where Jesus said about this man that said he's going to tear down his barns and build bigger. And that's a question. Is that in and of itself wrong, to tear down my barn and build it bigger? Once again, I think it's the overall attitude of life that Jesus was addressing. and that's how that attitude displayed itself in something like that. But I think we would all agree that for someone to build up his business and all that, that can be done in the right way, with the right spirit. So it's not so much in the thing in itself, it's the thing that comes with that attitude.
Absolutely. The attitude is what makes or breaks is what defines whether it's a plan or a boast. Now, verse 16. Now ye rejoiced in your boastings. All such boasting is, or rejoicing is evil. I looked up a couple of those words and phrases. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So verse 13 is said with an attitude of arrogance or boasting. It'll get us into trouble. But we're going to assume for now that if it's a plan, it's okay. Verse 17, he says, the word says, therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Sure, we've all heard that phrase. Go ahead, Ron.
There's a verse just before chapter 4, verse 18. It says, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by them who make peace, and that comes at the tail end of some previous thoughts. And my personal opinion on chapter 4 is it's a revealing of that verse. And where do wars and fightings come among you? Friendship with the world. Verse 10, desire to have prominence amongst your brothers in your community. To go out and make money. The reality is, even amongst your brothers, you will always have gifted people. You'll always have people that will that need to lead out and be in different facets of the church, even. And so, a counterproductive way of looking at this chapter, I believe, is to always fight it down. You know, like be against wealth, be against. Go into extreme humility and then build doctrines around humility that are just, we see, don't work if you read the history of mankind. But if you're a man who or a woman whose heart is to have righteousness and you sow peace in your family, in your community, amongst your brothers in the church, it'll fight against the other side of what chapter 4 is bringing out here, I think. And I think it's an attitude. It's played out in your life. You know, even the thing about having money, money is a blessing. Go anywhere in the world where they can't buy it, but they need to live. And we can see that being able to feed yourself and help yourself is a blessing, right? But that wicked heart that tries to use God to further his cause and still want all the benefits of the world, I think is what James is talking about here. And if we boast in that, we'll be destroyed. And we've probably all been there. But I know I've met men who say, Lord willing this and Lord willing that and Lord willing everything. But they're still greedy men. Just drop their saw off their sawhorses and and they'll just ream you out anyway, right? Because you bust up their new saw. So what about the Lord willing, right? I'd go as much deeper than what just falls out of your mouth, right? Albeit I do agree that sometimes we need to say that you know, we verbally say, yeah, Lord willing, I will go here or there. Because sometimes the stakes are high and people need to know it. Those are my rambling thoughts on that.
Well, thank you. It's like Jonathan said, it's a hard issue. If verse 13 is a plan that is subject to God's redirection in our hearts, if we make our plans of verse 13, we're gonna do this or that, and if that is a plan, a general plan in our mind that is subject to God's redirection, then we'll get it right. If in our hearts that statement is a selfish plan or a boast, then we're not going to be open to opportunity to do good, as referred to in verse 17. And we're going to miss the opportunities to do good. And that's where it becomes sin, I believe. But if we keep ourselves open to opportunities to do good, open to God's redirection, then we will take these opportunities, even though they might interfere with this plan of ours that may actually involve getting gain. And there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. Now we carry on into chapter 5, and it's kind of a continuation. It doesn't really, it just tackles another angle of it, talking fairly directly to the rich men. Go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers whom have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and have been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. I believe this is talking to men that had their verse 13 as a boast, or at the very least as a selfish plan of ambition. If we plan our day, like verse 13, in a boastful way, then I believe we've forgotten how temporal riches are, how temporary they are. And we've forgotten that doing good is eternal. If we can somehow keep our heads around that wealth is temporary and good deeds are eternal. And I know it's hard sometimes. Let me put it this way. I stumble and fall on that surprisingly regularly. but if we can keep that keep working at remembering that, I think it'll go a long way in helping us avoid this scenario at the start of verse 5. Before I get too long-winded on this, have any of you got any other thoughts on verse 5 here? Or chapter 5. Ray?
It's a question more than thought, perhaps. I've wondered numerous times when reading through the book of James, whether James is always speaking to believers or brothers, or whether he kind of goes off and speaks to non-believers, specifically in chapter 4 and the first part of chapter 5 that you read. I don't know if it matters, but it sort of does, because like, if he's speaking to believers, he's just being really, you know, not couching his words with any kind of proper religious dialect, and I always figured he was, because chapter 1, 2, and 3, he says, my brothers, my brothers, my brothers, and in chapter 5, he, verse 7, then he again speaks to my brothers. But I've been wondering here in the last little while whether he is speaking to brothers in chapter 4 and 5. I'd be interested in knowing what people think. If that hijacks where you want to go, just ignore it.
No, we're not going to ignore that. That's actually a good question. I hadn't got that deep.
Verse 11 of chapter 4 talks about, there's at least a small passage there that would be talking to brothers and sisters, I guess.
To a point, I think, most of us, at times anyway, fall into the same or at least dabble in the same temptations that non-believers deal with. So to a point, I guess we could say whether he was talking to believers or non-believers doesn't matter. Although I'm not going to say that too loudly, because it would be interesting to know. Some of what he's describing here in the first part of chapter 5, I would like to say, I hope, wasn't believers. Matt?
The whole context, I think, of this book is speaking to believers who were under a lot of persecution. And in the time that they were, the Jewish system was still putting a lot of pressure on them. So the Jews that converted to Christianity were pretty much excommunicated. They could hardly even make a living. And they were, you know, they were looking at the promises that Jesus had given them, that he was going to soon be back. And I think there was a lot of believers that were kind of turning back to the Jewish system in order to survive. And maybe they were having some doubts on, you know, is this new covenant thing really real? Is the timing all right? That kind of thing. So I would see like this, the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of 5, maybe being to some of those who would have turned back, and now they were able to make a good living again. And And some of them may have been taking advantage of some of the others who, like in the start of chapter 5 there, some of the others who couldn't really make a living, so they could maybe make them work for them and withhold wages like it talks about in verse 4. I don't know. But he was saying that they're laying up wealth for themselves, but their destruction's coming. And I don't know, I would see that as physical, probably, but in the time that they were there, in the context.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, so it could be written to kind of backsliding believers.
He addresses the letter, the Epistle of James, he addresses the letter to my brethren, and then he refers to his brothers throughout the book. In fact, in the beginning of every chapter, like in chapter 2, it starts with my brethren. Chapter 3 starts with my brethren. And then chapter 4 says, where do wars and fights come from among you? So I'm assuming he's speaking of his brothers. But then notice in chapter 5, he says, come now, you rich. And there I would tend to think he's not referring to his brethren anymore. He's referring to another class of people, because he refers to them as you rich. And then there's strong condemnation, which wouldn't seem like he's describing a believer. But then when you go down in chapter 5 to verse 7, he then seems to turn a corner, and now he's addressing his brothers again, where he says, therefore, be patient, my brethren. So maybe, like Matt was saying, there was Christians that were being taken advantage of by the rich. And so he's describing the condemnation of those rich people, and then he switches back to speaking to the brothers. He says, because of this, we need to be patient. And then for the rest of the chapter there in verse 5, he keeps, in verse 12, he says, but above all, my brethren, and then in verse 19, brethren. So I think the letter was written to Christians, but then in the letter, at times, he addresses unbelievers as well. Maybe switches back and forth.
He addresses unbelievers partly for the sake, possibly, of pointing out to believers why they don't want to be jealous of these guys. Anybody else? Is there a risk that we as... Did you have someone, Ron? Is there a risk that we as brethren could fall into this trap of taking advantage of others? Kind of a stupid question, isn't it, Ray? Because there's always a risk of backsliding and falling. It was one of the things that I asked myself. Maybe because it's so plainly and simply condemns that kind of stuff, and that if it's that serious, then it bears noting. And one of the thoughts I came up with was, if we focus on the profit, on the profits that we plan to make in our plans in verse 13, then we are immediately at greater risk of doing exactly that, shortchanging our employees, cutting corners. And if those profits are not the main focus, then I think we are immediately in a less risky scenario. Along with that, I'd like to think that I'd never cheat an employee out of his wages. But what if we... at what point is it the same thing to rob our families of time with us in order to accumulate more business wealth? Like, I'd like to think that I'd never cheat an employee out of his wage, but I could... I wonder if I know the difference between spending enough time in the shop and too much. Somebody care to come up with a solution or a recipe for getting that right every time?
I don't have a recipe at all. But I would think, with what you're referring to, a good start would be to listen to your family.
I didn't get that last line, sorry.
I said, I don't have a recipe, but I would think that a good start in knowing whether you spend too much time at work or whether you don't would be to listen to your family.
Okay, yeah. And then a little bunny trail. We're pretty much out of time here, but along with this thought of accumulating wealth versus like he says in verse 7, be patient and count on the Lord. Where's the balance between saving for our old years when we can't work and trusting to God to provide? And that's one I've been working on for probably 20 years and I haven't come up with an answer, so I don't suppose we will this morning, but I'm going to leave that with you to think about. I am kind of leaning towards trying to wrap this up next week, the last part of chapter 5, and then that'll conclude our studies on James. So thank you for now.